Welcome to Do Different Better Show, where we talk about wealth wisdom and money moves, making finance simple for everyday people. I'm your host, Elaine Rasmussen, founder and CEO of Social Impact Now, Connect Up Institute, and general partner of the Integrated Capital Fund. Thank you for joining me today. In our first episode, we'll talk about what this show is all about. I'm also going to share with you my background and how I got into finance. But I'm also going to share with you my journey with money, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But first, a little more about this show. Do Different Better is a no-nonsense, groundbreaking show dedicated to financial and wealth education tailored for everyday people. This show empowers you with practical insights, strategies, and expert advice to achieve financial success and build wealth. Every episode presents profound conversations with industry experts, thought leaders, accomplished entrepreneurs. These discussions delve into crucial things like banking, budgeting, investing, real estate, retirement, wealth building, entrepreneurship, and so much more. But also, we're going to talk about innovations in the finance sector and how they might impact your personal bottom line or make your life easier. We'll talk about financial and wealth education that is tailored for everyday people, and professionals might learn a thing or two as well. Expect a straightforward yet insightful exploration on all things finance on this show. I'll interview a wide variety of people representing traditional as well as some innovative finance and banking. I'll also talk to regular people like you and me about our money journey and their experience that have shaped their relationship with money. Once again, good or bad, there will be something to learn for everyone. And finally, we'll break down banking and finance jargon and give you these practical and tactical and brilliant ways to align your money with your values. Me and my guests will inspire you to adopt a financial mindset that empowers you to be more strategic about how you spend your time, your talent, and your treasure. The show might make you laugh, might make you cry, but you'll learn some stuff. But most importantly, I hope this show drives you to transform your relationship with money and finance in all the ways that it shows up in your life, where you live, where you work, and where you play. So why this show and why now? I thought it was really important that we don't talk about money enough, but it is the thing that is pervasive in our life. We deal with money almost every single second of the day. If we're not doing a Lyft and sending money to the Lyft driver, if we're in a restaurant, we're buying lunch, we're balancing our checkbook or not balancing our checkbook, but we are interfacing with money. We have put money into a 401k, but we have no idea where is our money actually going once we take it out of our checking account or out of our paycheck and put it into our 401k. Money is all around us, but it is a thing that we talk about the least. And I have found in doing the work that I do that it's really valuable and important to really make these connections between how do we manage and think about our money today and where did it all start? What were those stories or what were those experiences that we don't even know shape how we think about money? It informs our financial insecurity. It informs our, if we might have a cavalier attitude towards money. But all of those things influence our decisions in making money. And then when we take on a partner and they have a different money story, very rarely do couples talk about their money story and their money journey so that they can come to some understanding, which is why many relationships fall apart because of money. It's not necessarily the lack of having it, but that there hasn't been a real conversation about what are the various perspectives that people are bringing. And quite frankly, what is the baggage that they're bringing to the conversation of money? So this show I thought was really important. We've just come out of a pandemic. And there's a lot of insecurity. There's lots of layoffs that are happening. So I really thought that the time was really perfect at this moment to sort of talk about and unpack money, but also finance. I think when we think about finance, it's always, we think about investors, and investors are really these wealthy people who know so much more than us regular working everyday people. But I will just tell you, I've met a lot of these investors. Many of them are no more smarter than you are. And quite frankly, everyone is an investor. That's my philosophy. When you decide to go to Target versus Walmart, you are making an investment. You are choosing to support a certain way of thinking, a certain way of being, or a representation of a brand. That is making an investment, right? You buy something at a particular place that you could buy probably almost anywhere, but you chose to buy it at that place for one reason or another. That's an investment where you choose to put your money as far as a financial institution. Where you bank, I like to say, where does your money sleep at night? Is your money in a financial institution that is working against your interests or working for your interests? When we think about credit unions versus traditional banks versus a community bank, all of those work a little bit different. While they all may offer financial services, what is happening with that money and how is it coming to or from your community? So once again, we have all of these things that are related to money that we don't necessarily talk about. And so I'm hoping that this show is really timely and insightly of us generating more conversations, building some more transparency around money, and having us really lift the veil around the secrecy and the taboo of talking about money, because it has such a big influence on all of our lives. I really want us to be talking about it more. How does it influence us? Where do we get it? How do we get it? How do we think about it? How can we understand how money actually moves, right? When we see gas prices go up, what is that an indication of? When we see the price of milk go up, what is that an indication of, right? There are things that you can kind of predict about our economy by just noticing some everyday things about how money is or isn't moving, right? So we're going to unpack all of that, and we're going to make it really easy to understand, which is probably another thing. People are intimidated about the conversation of money. Maybe you have the good fortune of having a wealth advisor, and you probably don't understand half the word that they're saying. Well, we're going to break all of it down and make it simple, easy to understand. We're going to try to not use terms that are complicated. And if we do, we'll try to define those terms in the easiest way possible. But I really want to encourage you to send me some DMs on my social media channels. I really want you to comment, but email me, send me anything. If there's a question that you have, we will bring it to this show. This is such a passion of mine. I think it's so important and so valuable. And it's had such a huge impact on my life of reimagining my relationship with money. I just know the benefit it served me, and I hope that this will serve you. If there's something you want us to talk about, please let me know. Hit me up on YouTube, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Social Impact Now, or you can find me at Money Moves Maven. You can also go to my company website, Social Impact Now, at www.socialimpactnow.com. You can support my nonprofit at Connect Up Institute, which is www.connectupmn.org. And you can see all the wonderful work that we do around working with entrepreneurs and working, talking with impact investors and really getting impact investors, as well as regular investors, to really reimagine how they work with communities of color, how they work with small businesses, empowering more money to go into those opportunities. You've been listening to Do Different Better with your host, Elaine Rasmussen. Coming up next, I will share more about my own personal money journey.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Do Different Better. I'm your host, Elaine Rasmussen. We've just been talking about what this show is about and how our conversation will inspire you to transform your relationship with money. So in this part of the segment, I'm going to be talking about my own money story. I'm going to get real vulnerable with y'all. I'm going to talk about sort of my first memories of money and how it kind of influenced my thinking or not thinking about money. So a little bit about me. I'm originally from Hollywood, California. Yes, the actual Hollywood. It's a place. People live there. People grew up there. And that's where I'm from. I grew up poor. I grew up in a two-bedroom apartment. That was how I spent most of my formative years from the time I was in first grade until I was about 16, 17 years old. I shared a bedroom with my brother, and we lived in a apartment, an eight unit apartment building. Some of my models around money are how I saw the people most closest to me that I learned about money from, or their behaviors around money. The first one was my grandmother. My grandmother was a spitfire. She was this little itty bitty lady. She was 5 feet tall on a good day. She was like a size like two. She was just a super, super tiny lady, but very, very fiery and very, very feisty. Just to give you sort of a clue of how she was, her favorite artist was Prince. So I find it ironic that I now live in Minnesota. I feel like turn around, you know, how life has its own circles, but she loved Prince. Her big goal in life was to buy a red Corvette. She loved that song. And so she wanted to buy a red Corvette. But the closest that she got was a red Mazda RX-7, which just made her just as happy. She was a live-in geriatric nurse. So we would only see her on Sundays, which was her day off. So as soon as she would get off of work, she would come to our apartment where my brother and I were, and she would pick us up, and she would take us to the corner liquor store where she would buy her cigarettes, she would buy her beer, and she would buy her newspaper. But then she would also give us some money to go to the store to buy ice cream. So she would take us from the liquor store. We would go over to what was then Thrifty's. It's now, I think, Rite Aid. And she would always give us money so that we could buy ice cream. And I remember at a certain age, my grandmother started giving me more money than my brother. And I didn't ask any questions. And eventually she told me the reason why. And the reason why she was giving me more money, I thought it was because I was the oldest. My brother and I are 5 years apart. But what she said to me was, "I'm giving you more money because you're not asking for it." My brother was a consummate beggar of money. Every time my brother would ask for money before she even hit the door, he would listen for her footsteps coming up the stairs. And as soon as the door would open, he would ask her, "Did she get paid?" And she hated that. And so that was my first clue around the sensitivity around money. But I really didn't understand money's influence, right? But those are some of my first memories of money. The next sort of person in my life that has influenced my experience with money was my mom. So with my mom, as I mentioned, my mom was where we were working class family. My mom worked, my stepdad worked. My mom worked in a college bookstore. And I remember my mom on a regular basis borrowing money from my grandmother. And what was even more memorable was when my mom would pay the money back. And let's say my mom borrowed $100. When she would give the money back to my grandmother, she would give it to her in payment. So she would say like, "Oh, I have $20 this week." And I distinctly remember my grandmother saying, "I didn't give you $20, I gave you $100. So I want you to give me the money the same way I gave it to you." And that was a really powerful thing to hear. I'm just like, one, it was like, what? This person was standing up and saying, "Nope, this is not how this negotiation is going to go down. This is what I want to do." And then the other side of my mom sort of rearranging the arrangement without having a conversation. So I didn't have words at the time, but it was just watching all of this unfold, their relationship of money between the two of them, and then me watching this as a child. The thing that I learned later, or I shouldn't say later, but what I saw as I became a teenager was I couldn't understand, was my mom just not good with money, or what was really happening? Why were we in these precarious situations? I grew up with a lot of housing insecurity. We were being evicted. Now, the other part of this, which I'll get into, the third person who was very influential in my money story is my stepfather. So my stepfather, my dad was murdered when I was very, very young. I never really knew my father. My mother remarried not too long after. And he was a great guy for a while. He worked at Braille Institute, which, if you're not familiar with Braille Institute, is an organization that provides resources and training for people who are deaf and blind, which I love. So that was another community that I grew up around regularly. I was around blind and deaf people most of my formative years. But eventually, at some point, I don't know all the reasons why, my stepfather became an alcoholic and then eventually became a drug addict. And part of this money story was we were regularly bailing him out of jail or having to pay court fees. I say we, my mom, who was working three jobs. She was working at the bookstore. She did hair and nails on the weekend and in a salon. And then she would take side jobs and do nails for girls that I went to school with, right? And so it was just this weird sort of dichotomy of like watching circumstances related to money, but not really knowing the backstory of money. So with all of that, it really just became this very interesting dynamic of understanding these very three different perspectives. You have somebody who is this constant source of money. You have a person who is this constant drain on money. And you have this person in the middle, who is my mom, who's navigating the two. And so I wouldn't say at the time that I had this epiphanal moment around money, but it was some, there were those things that stayed with me and had a very subliminal effect on how I thought about money, how I dealt with money. And so I'll get into a little bit about that, but I wanted to give that background of just all of the stuff that comes along that we don't even know is planting seeds in our money memory garden, right? That then pop up some other time, like a garden, you plant your seeds, but you might not see a harvest for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months, right? Well, the same thing happens with some of these stories around money. We may have observed some things, but they really don't pop up into our life or impact our life until maybe much later, sometimes decades later. And then we have these aha moments of like, oh, financial insecurity, you know, wastefulness, comfort, you know, retail therapy, all these things. But we'll put that on a bike rack and we'll visit that in a minute. Now I'm going to So that was my formative years, I'd say, all the way up until I went away to college, right? So when I got to college, I did all the things that college people normally do. I got into trouble with credit cards. I thought that because I had checks that there was money in the bank. That was not the way that it works, right? I was not balancing a checkbook. I was not checking my bank account. And you have to remember also, there was no like online banking at the time. Everything was still manual. You had to write down all of your checks and you had to keep track of your own deposits and your own withdrawals, right? Being responsible. But I got into trouble with credit cards and that was a very painful experience because no one had ever had a conversation with me about money. No one had ever had a conversation with me about credit cards. And you go to college and there are all these credit card companies lined up waiting for you. They're just waiting for you. And of course I signed on that. I'm like, oh, free money. Yes, I'm here for it. Now, obviously I knew it wasn't free, but I also didn't have a concept of what it meant to pay back on a regular basis. So remember, my mom paying my grandmother back was on this like part, you know, payment plan special, right? That she created, that was of her own making, right? So that on the back of going to college, and then getting a job working as a stock analyst at Shearson Lehman Brothers. Shearson Lehman Brothers isn't a thing anymore. They, I think, were acquired by American Express and acquisition after acquisition. But Shearson Lehman Brothers was a huge financial institution. And I was working in the office in Santa Barbara, which is where I was going to school. And it was an amazing job. Now, stock analyzing and managing money are two different things. They are not the same thing. But just having some of the analysis that I had to do as a stock analyst, I was a researcher. So my job was literally go and research stock. That was before, once again, before the internet. We had to actually manually look at investor reports. I had to manually go and do research on these companies, read their investor relations statements and things like that, and make an analysis based on what I thought, like the greatest, whether these companies were great or not. I had a portfolio of 20 stocks that I was constantly regularly researching. And so to be able, and here's a fun story. So I remember one of my stockbrokers that I work for, he wanted me to pick three stocks. And out of all my research, which ones did I think were like going to be the best stocks? Now, mind you, this is 1988. Okay, just wanted to tell you that. And the stocks that I picked, I don't remember the third one, but the first two were Costco and Home Depot. And boy, do I wish I had even $50 to invest in stock back then. I'd probably be a very, very wealthy woman at this point, but I digress. So what ended up happening was I did that work for a while, but I realized I was the only person working in this organization. I believe I was the only female who wasn't a secretary, right? And I was, if my memory serves me correct, I was the only person of color. And while I love the work, I realized I did not have the emotional fortitude to be in an industry where there weren't a lot of people who looked like me. So I ended up leaving that job and going into marketing as a profession from college. But once again, that's a little side story. We can come back to that another time. So being a stock analyst really informed me being able to understand how money actually moved and how it worked. And what I was always grateful to that job, even though I pursued a career in marketing, what I really loved about that job was that job educated me to be able to read the Wall Street Journal and understand the Wall Street Journal and understand when I saw on the news something about anything that was happening with our economy, I could make an analysis and understand how that was going to impact me directly, right? And I really believe that that was one of the first pivotal relationships that informed how I thought about money that I believe was more positive, right, as opposed to negative. Then I started working. I ended up leaving school after a couple of years. I ran out of money. So I moved back home for a couple of years. And while I was in that transition, while getting ready to go to my next university, I started working at Nordstrom. Once again, this was in Los Angeles, California. And this was my first exposure to what I consider wealthy people. I was working in the Westside Pavilion Nordstrom, which if you're familiar with that area, it's really this weird juxtaposition. We're very close to Beverly Hills. We're really close to Century City. We're really close to USC and UCLA. But we're also really close to West Hollywood and some parts of Los Angeles that aren't necessarily affluent. But working in that store, it's the store that was really close to a lot of celebrities. So I got to see a lot of celebrities, but I also got to see people who were uber wealthy. And it was really interesting to see how those folks were so understated. And that was also really interesting to see. They would come in and they would spend a lot of money, but if you were to look at them, you would not know that they had a lot of money. And when I say a lot of money, people would come in. I was a salesperson. They would come in and they would spend $10,000 at a time, $15,000 at a time, not blink an eye, and put it all on a credit card. And I was like, whoa, that was such an exposure of like, wow, what would it be like to just shop in one day and spend $15,000? that blew my hair back. And that really started me wanting to understand the psychology of these people. And while people who were newly wealthy were very extravagant, were very open and very allowed about their wealth, people who had wealth, like uber wealth and had generational wealth, were not so. And so just seeing that juxtaposition of how people show up with their money, I thought was fascinating. So I went back to college, finished up college, got my degree in international business and marketing, and started working at some manufacturing jobs. Well, at the age of, in my late 20s, I got pregnant. And that once again started the road of another precarious sort of relationship with money as a result of being pregnant and with an unplanned pregnancy. And I was at the time, I had moved in with my grandmother, who was living at the place where she was working. And what I didn't know was that my mom was also living there, because my mom was, again, experiencing some housing insecurity. And I don't remember all the stories. I don't remember how it all happened, but I ended up being like kicked out. Not because of anything that I did, but just the circumstances were like, all of us can't be here. You've got to go. But I've got this baby. And I ended up sleeping in my car, quite frankly. And I ended up, through the grace of all that's good, I had an ex-boyfriend that took me in. So I stayed with him until I got back on my feet. I had a college degree, but I was working at a job. I got another job. I was working at a job that was paying me $12 an hour. So now we're up to like 1996. That's not a lot of money now, and it wasn't a lot of money then. It certainly was too much for somebody who was a college graduate, right? And but I could not find work that was of my college degree and paying me a decent wage. So what I learned from that experience was how deeply, when you are in survival mode, you cannot think of any, there's no literal room in your brain to think about how to be strategic or how to get yourself out of the situation. Your brain is literally just filled with getting to the next moment or getting to the next hour or getting to the next day. There's literally is no capacity to think beyond that. And so when we think about people who are maybe experiencing housing insecurity or people who are living under very strenuous financial situations, and we make comments about, well, why can't you just fix it or why can't you just change it? It can be a paralyzing experience to live life hour by hour and not be sure what's going to happen and being using all of your energy to prepare for the eventuality or what might happen versus how do you create a new reality? There's so little space in your brain to think about that. And so that was a really powerful experience of just trying to make that transition. So how I made that transition was I had another friend of mine. Eventually I was working and then I got laid off. I was living in a hotel because I had left my apartment because my son's father and I had given up our apartments because we had broken up. So I was in housing insecure again. And it was really I didn't know what I was going to do. And I had a friend of mine who was living in Las Vegas and I was telling him what I was going through. And he said, come to Las Vegas. Me and my girlfriend will come to LA. We will pick you up and we will bring you back to Las Vegas and you can live in our house. And that really, once again, getting out of survival mode, knowing that I was going to have a place to sleep. I know that I was going to be fed. I know that my son was going to be fed. That allowed me then to like breathe so that I can start to strategize about what am I going to do and how am I going to do it, right? So that really was a pivotal shift in understanding a little bit of insight into like what my mom might have been going through and she could not think beyond what was happening in the moment and managing this person who she was in life partner with, who was constantly extracting, being a source of taking money out of her pocket, right? So all of that to say that's like that all of those things have really informed me really getting into entrepreneurship. And I call myself, but the first two times I was an entrepreneur, I was an accidental entrepreneur. I fell into entrepreneurship. So the first time I fell into entrepreneurship was a result of losing a job. And I was on unemployment, couldn't find another job for like over 7 or 8 months, could not find a job. I was out there beating the streets and could not find a job. And so I was getting desperate because I knew my unemployment was running out. So I literally called everybody I went to college with and I said, hey, I'm available to do some marketing projects or PR projects. Let me know if you have anything. And one of my college colleagues said, I've got a job for you. And that job led to another job. That job led to another job. I wasn't trying to be an entrepreneur. I literally was just trying to survive. I was trying to feed my son. I was trying to feed myself. I was trying to keep a roof over our head. And that led to more work, and that led to more work, and that led to more work. And then that led me to working with a very large company, an Australian handbag company. I ended up working for Warner Brothers Studios. I ended up doing some work at DreamWorks Studios. And so I just happened to like create a business out of that. And I was doing great. I was doing amazing for 3 years. I grew the business. I had a part-time assistant. It was amazing. And then 9/11 happened. And as any marketing professional will tell you, when disaster strikes, usually that's when all money stops moving. And that's what happened after 9/11. Within 60 days of 9/11, all of my contracts dried up. I was actually on the Warner Brothers lot when 9/11 happened. And the shows that I was working on, all of them got canceled. And so I was back to the drawing board and trying to figure out what I was going to do and how I was going to live, right? And so all of these things, you know, these ups and downs that I've had to experience of having money, then not having money, having money, then not having money, has, I think one of the things one of my friends has said to me, it's like, you've gone through all of that. And so now you know how you can lose money, but you also know that you can get it back. And so I don't know if that's a good thing. I don't know if I would have liked to have gone through all these experiences to get there, but here we are. Right. But I can certainly understand and have empathy for people who have enduring financial insecurity, right? Whether they've gone through something like what I've gone through, or even something maybe as mild, but for them was really, really significant. My partner and I have these conversations all the time. When we first got together, he would talk about, I grew up poor. And I said, yeah, but you grew up in a house, right? That's very poor, different poor experience than not knowing whether or not you're going to be evicted that week. Right? Those are two different things. But I also don't want to take away from his experience. His experience was very real for him, right? So these are some of the things that we really, really want to be mindful of when we're having conversations with our partners around their money story and our money story. But back to my entrepreneurship journey. So that was my first introduction to entrepreneurship. My next journey into entrepreneurship was really thinking about, once again, I was laid off of a job and so I remembered what worked for me the last time that I was out of work. So I basically did the same thing I did before. I called everybody I knew. Unfortunately, my network was a little bit bigger at this point because I'd been working in marketing and advertising for a while. So I can now call up people in my field and ask for work. And that started a whole nother, I got some work. I did a really good job that translated into some other work, got a really good job, transferred that into other work, got more work. But then at that point, now it was a matter around, how did I want to spend my time? Because time is also has a value, right? And I think sometimes, particularly in American culture, we don't value time. We don't value our own time and we don't value other people's time. But that time has value. When you choose to use Instacart to get your groceries or delivery, Target delivery or some other Walmart delivery or Costco delivery over getting them yourself. A lot of times that's a choice of how am I spending my time? Because my time has value, right? When I talk to entrepreneurs, I often talk about, I don't care how big your business is. I don't care how small your business is. Think about yourself as a $300 an hour employee. And when you think about yourself as a $300 an hour employee, hopefully it gives you this prism by which you can make decisions about what is the best use of your time. Now, that's not to say, I will tell you, in my company, I am not beneath, it is not beneath me to take out the garbage, right? But if there's a matter of me taking out the garbage and writing checks to people, to vendors or to employees, I need to be writing checks, not taking out the garbage. Somebody else can take out the garbage. There's a higher use of my time in writing checks to vendors and employees than it is for me to take out the garbage. So it just gives me this visual of like, how am I spending my time? Because my time has value, right? So I lost my train of thought, but I'm going to try to get back there. But so just thinking about the entrepreneurship journey and how we spend our time and what is valuable and what's meaningful, I've just learned that it is not just about the money, but how we actually are living and how are we, where do we put our time and our energy to? And does that have a return on investment? Right? Being intentional about how we are leveraging not only our financial resources, but all of our other resources, because they have a financial value as well. And I don't want you to take away from this conversation that everything should be about money. That's not the point of this. The point of this is that everything has value. And some of that has a monetary value and some of it has an intrinsic value. The value might be, I want to spend time with my family versus working. Yes, I can might get paid to do overtime, but I don't think any of us gets to the end of our life and say, we wish we had spent more time working, right? So our relationships or other, our hobbies, our relationships, other parts of our life have value and meaning. And sometimes it's easier for us to equate the two by giving it a monetary value. But I don't want you to take away from this conversation that money should be the focus. I want you to focus on value. And everybody's going to have a different value system. People are going to value their alone time over their family time. Some people will value their family time over time with their friends and colleagues. Some people might value work over their time with their friends and family. And that will shift and change over your life, right? How you feel when you are in your 20s might be different than how you are in your 30s, which might be different in your 40s, which is different than your 50s, right? So none of this, this is, when I say it's a journey, it really is a journey. Right. So thinking about all of those things really can kind of help start to examine where and how we might want to spend our money and our time. And is our money and our time working for us or against us? And what are we allowing or what are we putting in the way that will or will not allow us to do that or have more, I don't even want to say control, but management of these things and having a say and intentionality around those things to produce the life that we want. I personally believe that we can design our life to a certain extent. And if we can design our life, then it is up to us to help put open up the universe to put things in place that allow the life that we're trying to design to happen. But if we are not intentional or mindful and we just kind of are doing things randomly, whether that's with our money, right? If we want to retire at a certain age, that means we need to be thoughtful and intentional about how and where we spend and where we park our money, right? The relationships that we want to have, we need to be intentional about where we park our time and our energy. The relationships we want with our children, the relationship we want with our partners, all of those things are super, super important, right? So you've been listening to Do Different Better with your host, Elaine Rasmussen. Coming up, we're going to talk about what I do now and how do I come to this work and my passion around money conversations. Welcome back to Do Different Better. I'm your host, Elaine Rasmussen. We've been talking about my own personal journey with money and how it's impacting my life. And now we're going to be talking about what do I do now and how did I get here? So we just ended up in the last segment talking about my entrepreneurship journey. Well, prior to after my last bout in entrepreneurship, I needed more stable income. And so I went out and got a job and I started working in philanthropy. And I thought this was going to be amazing. Philanthropy, it's kumbaya. Everybody loves each other. They've got it all figured out. They've solved all these problems. And that wasn't what I experienced. I left corporate America so that I could have more flexibility with my time. But I will say that what I learned was very, very distressing when I got into philanthropy. And I'll tell this quick story. So I'd been working in philanthropy for a while, and I knew that there was something else that I wanted to do, but I wasn't really sure. So about 4 years into working in philanthropy, I went to this conference. I was in New Mexico. And the conference was a lot of high net worth people, investors, and philanthropic people. And I went to this pre-conference that was talking about what's called mission-related investing or program-related investing, which is basically a fancy term for when philanthropic organizations invest in things that are aligned with their mission versus giving a grant, right? It's an investment. They're looking for a return as opposed to a grant where they don't get a return on their money. And as everybody was introducing themselves, there were about 50 people in the room. There were two women and there were only five people of color. As everyone was introducing themselves, people were introducing themselves of, hi, my name is so-and-so from so-and-so, and I have X millions of dollars of assets under management. Now, I thought this was a very strange way to introduce yourself, but everybody in the room introduced themselves that way. And I was like, okay, noted, right? So as the training went on for about 3 hours, at the end of the training, I was like, I heard all these people talking about impact and talking about investing with impact. But as they talked about the investments they were making, it seemed to me with my finance background that these investments really were not as impactful as they could be. And some of them actually I could perceive as doing harm to the impact that they thought that they were trying to make. So after the meeting, I met up with a friend of mine who had been an impact investor for a while. And I asked her, I said, so let me make sure I understand what this thing called impact investing is. People who have found a way to not pay taxes on their money and hoard their money have now found a way to make money off of that money. And she, without missing a beat, said yes. I said, oh, okay, I'm a strategist by nature. I just need to know the rules of the game. And it was at that point I was on fire. I was like, we need to move money differently. Money needs to move in a completely different way than how it's moving right now. Otherwise, we are going to keep getting the same garbage we've been getting, right? And it was at that point I was on fire. It was like a lightning rod hit me. I was on a mission to change how money moves. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't know where I was going to do it. I was still working at this national philanthropic organization, but I was on a mission to do that. And so from there, what I decided to do was I wanted to learn everything I could about impact investing. I wanted to know who the players were. I wanted to know the reasons and rationale why people did impact investing. I wanted to know everything that there was to know. And it was at that point, fast forward 4 years after that, was when I decided to leave my last organization. And it was prompted by a conversation with my boss, and my boss ended up yelling at me. Now, I'm a grown-ass woman. I will not be yelled at at my job. And so I left my boss's office. I went to my office and I walked in my office. I closed my door. I called my spouse and I said, when I get home tonight, we need to have a conversation about me quitting my job. And that was on a Friday. I called my assistant on Saturday, told her I was leaving, and I quit on Monday. And at that point, I was like, I am now ready. I wasn't ready, but I was ready to work on my mission of moving money differently. And that is what I've been doing. And so 6 months after I left that job, I launched Social Impact Now, which is an impact investing and social finance advisory firm. But part of that journey was also I started to hear that other entrepreneurs were having trouble having these conversations around money, and they were having conversations around access to capital, and they were having conversations about where do they find investors. And it was at that point I started to think about how can we bridge the gap between the people who have money who want to do good and the people who will do good and need the money. So I launched in 2018, I launched the work of Connect Up. I created a summit called the Connect Up Summit, and that's where we brought together entrepreneurs, investors, and the larger entrepreneur ecosystem to really engage in deep relationship building that was not transactional, like a pitch competition. And we did our first conference in 2018. We did it in 2019, did it in 2020, 2 days before the government shutdown. And from that, and we have just grown the work that we do. So what does Connect Up Institute do? We are a social finance and enterprise development studio. We have conferences, we have accelerators, and we have an investment fund where we actually invest in entrepreneurs across Minnesota. I am so excited that I get to do this work. This is my passion. My mission in life is to move $50 billion to underestimated entrepreneurs and underestimated communities. So with that, we are kind of wrapping up our first episode. Let me know what you think about the show. If there's a finance question you have, or if there's someone you want me to interview, let me know. Tell me on socials. We've just wrapped up talking about my journey and my passion on democratizing money. Can't wait for next week's conversation. In the next episode of Do Different Better, I will be talking with Chelsea McDaniel, Director of Impact Investing, and Christina Lara Agudelo, Manager of Lending Partnerships. Both of them are at Common Future. Common Future has catalyzed 90 plus initiatives, sourced over 500 community-led solutions, and influenced $280 million of philanthropic money. We will be talking about innovative approaches to lending structures through their collaboration with organizations like Native Women Lead, Mortar, and Connect Up Institute. You've been listening to Do Different Better with your host, Elaine Rasmussen.